certainly at that time the title sequence was a piece of art before the film and was the moment for the designer to express his vision of the film in a way. It was an object completely separated from the film.
The great Michelangelo once said that genius is eternal patience. So, what does it say about the state of today's movies to find so many skipping the beloved art of the opening title? We'll present our passionate defense of the opening sequence today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
Oui, ça c'est du vrai burlesque, c'est-à-dire.
Yes, it's a true burlesque. There's comedy in the gestures, there's comedy in the waggery. Comedy that's very simple and very schematic.
The director of the new film Slack Bay, Bruno Dumont, reveals his love for whimsical comedy and genre mashing, and for the actress Juliette Binoche. And
it is a film shot in the partly destroyed city a few years after the World War. And you can see in this film Vienna as it was and you will never see again.
We'll take a trip to Vienna to find out why a classic 1940s film noir has become an eternal city attraction. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Our show today will take us to Paris and Vienna, but first, a quick stopover in a tiny seaside town in the north of France with the new film Slack Bay.
Mais oui, enfin, Billy a disparu ou non?
Mais je vais immédiatement prévenir la police.
La police? Mais pourquoi la police? Non!
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. It's the summer of 1910. Many tourists have mysteriously vanished from the stunning, though somewhat eerie, beaches of the Channel Coast. Breaking the unchanging sights of the sea are two families, the Van Petegems, a wealthy bunch who live in an old mansion, and the Bruforts, a bizarre family of fishermen. This wonderfully odd coupling takes an even stranger turn, however, with the arrival of two unlikely police inspectors who've brought with them some unwanted questions. Slack Bay recalls a kind of whimsical physical humour rarely seen on screens since the classic fluffy comedies of the 1930s. Its farcical mix of macabre with madness makes for a fairly strange concoction, but for director Bruno Dumont, it's precisely that mix that sparked his interest.
Oui, donc je pense en fait c'est de la tragédie.
Yes, I think that's because it's a tragic comedy. It touches on things that are serious and things that are not as serious, thus gaining a particular kind of nuance. It's a mix of people. It's a true burlesque. There's comedy in the gestures. There's comedy in the waggery. Comedy that's very simple and very schematic. It overlaps with other genres of comedy. I think there's a lot of register that comes together when making burlesque.
Ce mélange, dont le burlesque.
Pitching a film as a comedy, or a drama, or a dark tragedy might make for an easier marketing campaign. But for Bruno, it's the unexpected convergence of those genre lines that's key to the creation of something original.
There's tradition in tragedies and tradition in comedies, but there's not much overlap between the two because people have a tendency not to mix them together. I don't know many others who make that kind of mix because in the history of film, we tend to keep both in their original form. For example, Juliette Binoche is often confronted with tragic situations. They're more serious and dark. I'm asking for an interpretation that doesn't really go in that direction. The comedy comes from distancing the actor from the situation that they're in. She finds herself in situations that are particularly dramatic. When she speaks about the origins of her child, for example, we play on the juxtaposition between what the actor does, their interpretation, and the situation, which creates another contradiction.
Et la situation, et donc ça crée encore une contradiction.
Ah, mon Dieu, que c'est beau. André, non Jésus, que c'est beau.
Oh, regardez-moi ce paysage que vous avez là. Oh, Billy, n'avez-vous jamais rien vu?
Bruno Dumont, director of Slack Bay, which is out in cinemas this week. Mubi subscribers can catch Bruno's 2013 film, Camille Claudel, 1915, also starring Juliette Binoche. That's streaming right now. Still to come, we will explore the art of handcrafted title design with a visit to the Paris workshop of the artists behind the Saul Bass-inspired opening titles of Steven Spielberg's Catch Me If You Can. But first, this week's box office report. Wonder Woman continues its dominance at the top of the list, taking in more than $58 million. But an unusually long stretch of sweltering heat here in the United Kingdom could be bad news for cinema takings. In traditionally hot countries like Australia, scorching heat can actually be good for the box office, with air-conditioned multiplexes making for a perfect oasis. But sunny days are a little more of a novelty here in the UK. Last weekend was the worst for the past year for ticket revenue. Takings plummeted a whopping 62%. The Mummy is still sitting at number two and managed to score Tom Cruise his biggest ever global opening. But with such a high production cost, some are suggesting that the film could actually lose up to $95 million. This week's release of the very multiplex-friendly Transformers, The Last Night, should bring about some relief. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned.
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
If you've seen the new Wonder Woman film, you might have noticed the rather conspicuous absence of a title sequence. It's a trend that's picked up in popularity in recent years, in stark contrast, of course, to the original superhero film, 1978's Superman. But title sequences can be far more than a simple reminder of what you're watching. When done well, the titles are a chance for a film to establish its visual identity. And, as Christian Rudev discovers, a standout sequence can help push a film into the realm of legend.
That's it. Forget it.
When it comes to opening sequences, we're all a bit like Annie from Woody Allen's Annie Hall when she's called out for being late to a foreign film.
We're only missed the titles. They're in Swedish.
You want to get coffee for 2 hours or something?
2 hours? No.
In the mid-20th century, much of the American population was illiterate. Many cinemas wouldn't even bother raising the curtain on the screen until the titles were over and the action had begun.
This story is true. I ought to know. I not only covered it for my newspaper, I became a part of it. You read about Phil Regal in the papers. Enforcer for the underworld, they called him.
Today, with so many filmmakers terrified of inattentive viewers losing interest, a well-thought-out opening sequence can be a kind of silent rebellion. No one has had more of an impact on the art of the title sequence than Saul Bass. His work on director Otto Preminger's 1955 film, The Man with the Golden Arm, was among the first films to approach the title sequence as an original artistic expression, separate but complementary to the film. Nearly 50 years later, the Steven Spielberg film Catch Me If You Can paid tribute to Saul Bass by reinterpreting his signature style. Designers Florence Degas and Olivia Kunzel were delighted in turning back their creative clocks to the 1960s, an era inhabited both by the film's characters and the golden age of title design.
Certainly at that time the title sequence was a piece of art before the film and was the moment for the designer to express his vision of the film in a way. It was an object completely separated from the film.
Florence and Olivia could have called upon the kind of wonders of modern technology unavailable to Saul Bass, all while maintaining that handcrafted quality essential to capturing the essence of the art.
We believe that the work of the hand is able to transmit more directly from us to the audience something, an emotion or something very personal and true. And of course, we love to enhance this with the ultimate technology because we are people from today and we are fascinated by the technology and the sophistication. But our challenge each time is, despite of the technology, being able to let survive this fragile thing that comes from the human. The pleasure you have while you are making a creation is something that is transmitted to the audience. So we love to have fun while working on our creations. And for us, it seems having fun is also being able to make things by ourselves, not just giving orders to a crew, but also being able to draw by ourselves and do things at our level first. And this, we transmit it to the crew, who is able then to add something more.
Catch Me If You Can is, of course, set in the 1960s, and the title sequence acts as a kind of instant vortex back to the expressive simplicity of the era.
The reference was the 60s because the film was taking place in the 60s, so we have done the exercise to do a title sequence with the flavor of the 60s. Of course, we are certainly able to do different things, but perhaps the title sequence at that time was done with simple techniques. It was done by designers.
What we wanted to do when we had this subject, we said, oh, if by chance we could jump into a machine to go back in the time and be in the 60s and we are in this street with our studio and next studio is this designer and this other, etc. What could we do? So at that time we would have used the same tools, paper, ink, cutters, things like that. So that's why we decided to do something with our hands and using simple techniques.
By the early 1960s, 60% of cinemas had just closed down. The B-movies and cartoons, which accompanied feature-length films, quickly became too expensive and production soon stopped. Audiences were left with just one feature film for the same ticket price. Many saw A Night at Home with Television as a more attractive option. The title sequence gave audiences something to engage with before the film, an original artistic expression, and in some cases, integral to the plot. So next time, you find yourself struck by indecision at the candy bar, as you're running late for a film, ask yourself, would you really buy a newspaper, minus its front page, or skip the first paragraph of a Dickens novel? So then why would you pass on the opening sequence to a film? For Monocle, I'm Christian Radev.
Still to come, we'll take a tour of Vienna by way of a classic 1940s film noir. Stay tuned. Iconoclast, moralist, revolutionary, leader of avant-garde surrealism. That's just some of the ways that film director Louis Buñuel was described by the New York Times when he passed away in 1983. Two films looking back at his remarkable career are screening on Mubi this week, including his 1962 surrealist masterpiece, The Exterminating Angel. There's also Viridiana, which was the co-winner of the Palme d'Or at Cannes in 1961 and caused a stir with its scandalous story of religion and sex. Sample a whole month of movies for free right now. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. The final leg on our tour today takes us to Vienna. The classic 1949 film noir, The Third Man, is often considered the greatest British film ever made. But with its stunning expressionistic photography of the war-ravaged city of Vienna, it's also carved a special place for the city's residents and visitors. Its 4K restoration some years ago highlights just how significant a place it holds, which will come as no surprise to Kurt Schrammeck. As the owner of Vienna's Burgkino Cinema, he maintains quite a special relationship with the city's favourite film. Monocle's man in Vienna, Alexei Korolev, took a seat in the front row.
I never knew the old Vienna before the war, with its Strauss music, its glamour and easy charm. Constantinople suited me better. I really got to know it in the classic period of the black market. We'd run anything if people wanted it enough and had the money to pay.
Thus begins one of the greatest British films ever made, a 1949 thriller centered around a selfish American racketeer by the name of Lime, Harry Lime, played by Orson Welles, the eponymous third man. The film is set in post-war Vienna, Bonaparte a bit, and occupied by the four powers, but despite its decidedly international atmosphere, the Viennese have long since claimed it as their own. There's a third man tour, for instance, which will take you through the film's various locations, including into the sewers, the setting of its dramatic final scene. And at the iconic Burgkino, or Burg Cinema, on the Ringstrasse Boulevard, it's shown almost every day, alongside the latest foreign and Austrian productions.
Beginning from 1980, we are showing The Third Man, and at least 25 years we have got regular showings.
Kurt Schrammeck is the long-time owner of the Burgkino. He explains why The Third Man is so special to Vienna.
First, in 1980, it was quite common to make a reissue of a film. You could show films like The Third Man, also other film classics, for about 1, 2, 3 weeks. And of course, everything has changed since then. But The Third Man is a rare exception in this matter. I think it has to do with the fact that the film is some kind of document of the time when it was playing then and when it was made. It is quite unusual to make a film really on a place that can never be restored like it has been before. It is a film shot in the partly destroyed city a few years after the World War, and you can see in this film Vienna as it was and you will never see again. I think the film also captures the very special mood of these years after the war. Vienna was divided into four parts by the occupying forces of the victorious nations. The life was far from normal. And when you see this film, and you know that it was shot in these surroundings, then you get a feeling of a time that can't be compared to any other films also shot in those times.
Mm. Then I understand the film is also very special to you personally, because you own the rights to it, don't you?
Yes, it was in the late 70s when I realized that nobody cared about this film. And I also had the impression that the Viennese population didn't really like the film, because the people, as they were shown in the film, it's not a very good impression that people in the film make. And so this might have been one of the reasons. And anyway, the film wasn't available for more than 10 years before, and I thought it would be important to show it again. A year before I became the owner of the Burg Cinema, I had a small cinema in the 7th District and my own distribution company, and I tried to get the rights, and then I made a reissue, and it was a sensation. The film has been shown for six weeks. It was an enormous success, which can't be compared to anything today. And of course, this success couldn't be repeated in the following years. But what has remained is enduring interest of the people to see this film.
So it's still economically viable to show this film every now and again?
As a matter of fact, it's not about economics. It's okay, and I think it's just a pleasure to give people the opportunity to see this film. It's more about the people who want to see this film here, and the economic basis is solid. That's it.
Monocle's Alexei Korolev there, dimming the lights at Vienna's Burgkino Cinema with its owner, Kurt Schrammeck. And that's all for this week's edition of The Cinema Show. Next week, tune in for a very special Mediterranean tour. Today's show was mixed and edited by Kiran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin and Christian Radev. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.